produced by Jeffrey Cresselius, Joseph Cottrell and Ken Fuller. This is Yes Music Podcast, episode 611. Why did Rick Wakeman want Larry Fast?
Hi, this is Tony Kaye, and you're listening to the Yes Podcast.
Welcome to episode 611 of the Yes Music Podcast, two fans' exploration of the world's greatest progressive rock band. I'm your host, Kevin Mulryan, and co-host Mark Anthony Kaye will be along in a few minutes' time. You can always get involved with the podcast via the various different ways on the site, yesmusicpodcast.com. Before we start the episode this week, I'd like to draw your attention to a new project I've undertaken for next year. It's called Anthem 52, and will involve me writing and releasing a new choir anthem every week in 2024. I've included the short pilot episode after today's YMP episode, so hang around for that if it sounds like something you might be interested in. This week, Mark and I are once again indebted to Doug Curran for setting us off to find out more about keyboard innovator Larry Fast and his Tales from Topographic Ocean's connections. As you will hear, Larry was involved in the sound of the keyboards on Tales, something I did not realise until Doug posted a happy birthday message to Larry on the YMP Facebook discussion group last week. How much did you know about Larry's connections with Rick Wakeman? Let us know in the comments on the show notes for this week's episode. On the aforementioned YMP Facebook discussion group this week, Doug was prolific once again, adding the following. The news that the new Rick Wakeman 2024 calendar is available from Rick's web store, along with new Wakeman merch. A notice from Bandcamp that Mysterious Sessions by ex-Toto and Yoso singer Bobby Kimball is available. It includes Billy Sherwood, Tony Kaye, Patrick Mraz and Alan White. Also still available from Bandcamp, Synthesizer Classics by various artists, including Wakeman, Mraz, Downs, Jordan Rudess, Larry Fast, Thies van Leer, is that how you pronounce it, of Focus, and Derek Sherinian. It was released in August 2022. An unusual insight into Bill Bruford by way of his top three favourite reads in 2023. Never before heard information on Asia in late 83 from the brand new John Verity book. News that Adam Wakeman played with Deep Purple in concert this week, filling in for an ill John Airey. And this was also spotted by Ray Reithmeyer and Jeff Bailey. And new Christmas music on YouTube from John Anderson. Jeffrey Mason also chimed in with an interview with Trevor Rabin, Rick Wakeman's grumpy old Rick's ramblings for December 2023, a Rolling Stone feature on Yes from 1984, interviews with Bill Bruford in 1980, John Anderson in 1976, Steve Howe in 1979, Chris Squire in 1979, and the whole band on the Going for the One tour. And a studio photo of Anderson, which looks like early 1990s, perhaps. Ray Reithmeyer also joined the party this week with posts about the aforementioned Adam Wakeman Deep Purple news, a Q&A with Trevor Rabin about his new album, Rio, and the sad news of the death of Jim Ladd, former Billy Sherwood collaborator. Preston Frazier shared his annual Best of Rock in 2023 article, this time featuring Steve Lukather, Yes, Downsbraid Association, Derek Sherinian and Simon Phillips. And Brian Sullivan added a YouTube video of a 2011 charity piece called Heaven Sent from Robin Crow, Phil Keaggy and one John Anderson, as well as others. Charlie Nolan spotted a Chris Squire interview from 1979, and John Perez from Yes tribute band Close to the Yes is looking for a keyboard player. Good luck with that. Thank you to everyone who's been in touch in any way this week, including those who commented on last week's show notes. Doug Curran, David Axon, Paul Janes, and Aaron Steelman. It's always worth reading those comments, and this week is no exception. We are doing a slightly different version of Why Did Whoever Want Whoever this week, and Mark is with me now. Hello, Mark.
Hello there, Kevin. How are you doing today?
Okay, thank you. What about you?
It's been a busy week, but it's been an interesting week, and my prayers have been answered. I've asked the dear Lord to make a nice, warm Christmas for me, and it looks like it's going to be 8 degrees Celsius, 9 degrees. All this week is going to be nice and warm, so I'm very pleased with the upcoming week.
I suppose it rather depends on your definition of warm, but
well, compared to what it could be now, it could be like in the minus. So
yes, that's true. Okay, it's very windy over here at the moment, but quite warm. So anyway, let's get back to this then. So I've called this episode "Why Did Rick Wakeman Want Larry Fast?" And the reason for that is that Doug Curran posted to the YMP discussion group on Facebook, and I want to read out the little piece that he posted, which really kicked me off down another rabbit hole of trying to find out about Larry Fast. And it's a name I recognise, but didn't know a lot about him. So let's just read. It'll take a moment just to read this Doug Curran post. He said, "Happy birthday to pioneering keyboard composer Larry Fast, 72 today." This was last week. "He's best known for his 75 to 87 series of synthesizer music albums as Synergy, and for his keyboard playing and production work with Peter Gabriel, Foreigner, Nectar, Bonnie Tyler, Kate Bush, Hall & Oates, Meatloaf, Jim Steinman, Dr. Buzzard's original Savannah Band." That's apparently morphed into Kid Creole and the Coconuts. "Cool and the Gang, Annie Haslam, Randy Newman, FM, and the Tony Levin Band. He also composed music for the Cosmos TV series and other shows and movies, including Streets of Fire." So I'm going to come back and read the rest of what Doug Curran said after. I just ask you, Mark, Larry Fast, a name you knew, but in what context?
Larry Fast for me was somebody that I knew mainly because of Peter Gabriel. I remember when I got some of his earlier records, it was a name that I saw. You know, I think it was probably Peter Gabriel 3, maybe 2. I know he's involved in 3 and 4. That I know for sure. Because a lot of that ahead of its time keyboard sounds and stuff like that were all pretty much engineered by Larry Fast. And I mean, Peter Gabriel will be the first one to tell you that himself.
Yeah. It's an amazing lineup there with people like Kate Bush. And I know he did some remarkable stuff for her as well and all those others. But the part of Doug's post which really piqued my interest, of course, as you might imagine, with our current focus on Tales from Topographic Oceans, was the next part. He says, "In 1973, Larry was introduced to Rick Wakeman, the keyboard player with Yes, during a local radio interview after a Yes concert, and then travelled to the UK to work with Yes on their 1973 album Tales from Topographic Oceans. It was there he got a recording contract with Passport Records and started on the first Synergy album." So that's not something I'd heard of before. And I had a look around, and in fact, Doug sent me a part of an interview from Anil Prasad in 2004, where he explains a bit more about exactly what he did for Rick Wakeman, because I was, you know, completely unaware that someone like Larry Fast had worked with Rick specifically on Tales. Here's what Larry Fast said in 2004. "I worked on hardware for Rick. I was doing electronic music before recording professionally, and I wasn't very set financially. The Moog equipment was phenomenally expensive back then, even in today's dollars. I had a good background in electronics, so I was designing custom modules for myself. I first encountered Rick through my early work in US college radio, when Yes was first starting out in 1971. They were still travelling around in a station wagon and doing tiny little concerts. I spoke to Rick literally a couple of months after he joined the band, and we naturally touched on electronics, and when I described some of the things I built for myself, he said, 'I'd like to have those for myself. Would you build some of those for me?' And in fact, he had the road manager give me the deposit that night. About 6 or 7 months later, I delivered a finished custom sound synthesizer module to him, which he ended up using on the Yes Songs Live album. The first time I heard myself on the radio, in a sense, was hearing him use those modules on that album. And finally, he suggested I come to the studio when the band was recording Tales from Topographic Oceans to see how the device was working and offer some tips and techniques, as well as do a little upgrading. So I went to England for that, amongst other things. It was a good opportunity. I was able to spend a lot of time in the control room watching Eddie Offord work, and I learned a lot about the techniques that were important to the way British albums at the time were engineered." Okay, so my question from my completely lay perspective is, when he says a custom sound synthesizer module, which was used on Yes Songs, what's your understanding, Mark, of what that actually is? What is that piece of kit, a module?
To me, what that is it's a separate little device, whether it be a box or a rectangular shape or however it is, that has various knobs and, you know, switches and stuff like that. And basically from what I would understand is most likely he has to take an output from another keyboard, let's say a Moog or one of the other keyboards, like the electric piano or something.
Yeah.
Take the output into the input of this unit, and this unit now would alter the sounds. It would, you know, maybe it would have some different, you know, sine waves, or maybe he could put some LFOs in there and, you know, do manipulations of the sound through these boxes, right?
Right.
Kind of like if you ever watched a video for Pink Floyd making of the Dark Side of the Moon when they're doing On the Run, and you see Roger Waters fiddling with that unit and he's turning knobs and, you know, right, switching stuff. I'm thinking that it could be something along that device. So maybe he has something that, you know, maybe one of his Moogs plugged into that gave the Moog a slightly more different pitch to it, a different sound to it. Maybe he was able to add some filters to it to give it a sound that was not, you know, possible to get from a Moog on its own, right?
Ah.
So I'm guessing that this is what it was for. And it's even possible that maybe he could have constructed a unit and had a separate keyboard made for it just for that specific unit, right? It's not out of the, you know, thought of reason that he could have done that, right?
Mm.
But I'm guessing more likely, since he says that he went to the studio with him in 73 to work on Tales and, you know, help him out with some stuff, I'm guessing it's because he was using this device with the gear that he already had in studio, right? So I'm guessing that, you know, some of the sounds that we hear on this record could not have been made without his device. I'm wondering what sides he was talking about. You know, I'm wondering side two or what. Yeah,
it would be lovely if Larry would agree to come and talk to us about it.
Yeah.
But you know, we'll try and get him to come on, and because I would definitely, you know, my obsession with knowing how sounds are made. It would be great to speak to Larry about specifically what he did. But what you're describing is sort of the forerunner of MIDI, isn't it? And I've just started playing around with a MIDI keyboard connected to my MacBook Air, which I've got, which has been prompted by my daughter. She's doing some music technology in her course at the moment. So I've started messing about with that. But MIDI wasn't until later, was it? And for anyone listening who doesn't know what I'm talking about when I say MIDI, that's a sort of, it's still used today, isn't it? I mean, it's quite an old system, isn't it? The MIDI system. What does that do?
Well, MIDI is fascinating, and it's actually quite useful when you think about it, especially when it comes to keyboards. One of the greatest examples of this I saw early on when I was kind of still unsure about MIDI was I was friends with this guy who was in this band, and he was recording an album, and he had a keyboard player, and the keyboard player was, you know, in the studio doing his parts, and he was talking to me while the person was playing, and I said to him, it sounds pretty good, the keyboards, and he looked at me and goes, it doesn't matter what the sounds are not like. I'm gonna get them. I'll change them all later. And I'm like, what do you mean you're gonna change them all later? He goes, because he's recording the MIDI at the same time, right?
Okay.
On the computer. So when you have all the MIDI information, it'll record how he plays it and what he plays, but the sounds itself can be changed through MIDI because the MIDI information can be sent to another device, another sound thing, or like another sound module.
Yeah.
And you know, the same performance could be put through like another sound, like a string patch or a orchestra patch or a pipe organ patch. So that's the beauty of MIDI. It means that you don't have to be stuck with one specific thing. As long as you record the MIDI information, you know, you have a whole world of sounds that you can use at your disposal.
Yeah. And I suppose nowadays, because the kind of synthesis that you can have with software and with computers and synthesizers is so advanced, you really can play one thing and then it comes out as something completely different. And that reminds me of Steve Howe's use of the Variax, because that's a similar principle, isn't it? He plays something and something completely different comes out of the out of the speakers. And it also reminds me of when we spoke to Derek Dearden, and he was the one who came up with Alan White's drum synth machine. And again, that was done before MIDI. So, I mean, I don't pretend to understand the different processes, but MIDI stands for Musical Instrument Digital Interface, doesn't it? So,
yes,
it's a little bit later than this. And in fact, in Doug Curran's original post, he went on to talk about some of the amazing technical things that Larry Fast went on to do. He was a consultant to Moog Music in the development of the Polymoog. and the Memory Moog synthesizers. So that's 76 for the Polymoog and 82 for the Memory Moog, including voicing many of the original Memory Moog factory presets. So again, all these things that we, well, in the case of the Polymoog, are not terribly keen on when it turns up in Tomato and various other places. But yes, he was really heavily involved in the development of the sounds that we hear on a lot of the records that we've listened to. And he also helped introduce the first Fairlight synthesizer. And on the third, as you were saying, the third Peter Gabriel solo album in 79 to 80. So he's fully involved with that. And then he was involved in MIDI as well, as we've just been talking about, software projects as well on that. So he's an extremely influential, and I suppose one of those unsung heroes, because if you don't look into it like I've done this week, you would never realize that he was so influential and so important in the story of keyboards and synthesizers.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I knew that he was obviously very well versed in keyboards, and you know, he did a lot of things with keyboards, but I never realized how much he was involved behind the scenes, like the whole, you know, being involved with the development of the Moog and the Polymoog and the Memory Moog. And it was interesting though that I didn't realize that he had so much input on the Fairlight, because the Fairlight is one of the instruments that appears quite heavily in Peter Gabriel 3 and 4. I mean, the 3 one is interesting to watch the documentary on, because they go outside and record all sorts of ridiculous sounds, like smashing a television set or hitting a pipe with a hammer and stuff like that. And then they go bring it back into the computer system, enter it into the Fairlight, and they have this little pen that they can manipulate the sound waves with.
Right.
And it's a fascinating keyboard. And I mean, you can set it up so that on the keyboard, instead of getting like notes like a piano, you can have different pitches of the television being broken, you know? So, I mean, could you imagine an A sustained 9 chord of a TV breaking? I mean, I wonder what that sounds like.
Amazing stuff. But it takes this kind of trial and error, doesn't it, to really move forward in these sorts of things. I just wanted to say also that a couple of other people that we know very well, Annie Haslam, who worked on her 1989 release called Annie Haslam, called after her herself, and also toured and recorded with Tony Levin, obviously from Peter Gabriel and ABWH touring and all those sorts of things. And the Tony Levin Band also in 2002 and 2006, and appears on Double Espresso, which was a live album recorded by the Levin Band in 2002. So really quite up to date as well. Now, what we're going to do, as we normally do with these, why did somebody want something, want somebody episodes, is we're going to spend the gap between now and the next episode looking at an album, which hopefully should show us some of the reasons why Rick Wakeman was interested in Larry Fast. And he didn't really produce anything before he worked with Rick Wakeman that I can find particularly easily anyway. But from coming over to England and working on Tales, he then got himself into a lot of other opportunities, which he found. And throughout the 70s and 80s, he released 8, well, I think possibly 9 albums from this sort of band or collective or whatever you want to call it, called Synergy. And the first one of these has it was released in 1975, a wonderfully 1975 title, which is Electronic Realizations for Rock Orchestra, which I think is absolutely fantastic, absolutely brilliant. And it exclusively made use of synthesizers and electronic instruments. And in one of those brilliant tongue-in-cheek moments, they put on the sleeve, the first album said, "And nobody played guitar." The second album sequencer says, "And still no guitars," which they think is a tongue-in-cheek response to what Queen used to put on theirs. They used to put no synthesizers on their earliest albums. So this was a response to that, which is very, very funny. So I've taken just a few seconds listening to this, Electronic Realizations for Rock Orchestra, and it seems a bit meandering, but we're not talking about the music this week. And it feels quite new agey to me. from my initial few seconds, but let's see if that attitude changes. What do you think?
New age, that's right up Rick Wakeman's
well,
alley,
yes, that's as what I was
we
thinking,
all know.
Yeah.
He did a whole, what was it, like 7 years worth of new age records when he was at his lowest peak and needed some cash. He was making those new age records like left, right, and center. So he must have had a connection that way at least. But I had never heard this record. I have no idea what it sounds like. So I'm actually very excited about this, to go into a record with open ears and fresh perspective, which is very rare for me sometimes to have in these sort of situations. So I'm looking forward to it. And I was reading through some of these notes that you so nicely sent over to me about how the album was recorded. And he was talking about how he did like 4-track demos of these things. And then he goes into great detail how he said that, you know, he was working on 16-track machines, and he goes into all kinds of detail about it. So I'm very interested to hear this record and to see how it turned out.
It is fascinating, and I'll put the link to that little article which talks about precisely how this thing was put together. And I've just noticed in these notes as well that the third album states, finally guitars, sort of, because they used the guitar synthesizer played by Pete Sobel. So, very unusual for us. It'll be entirely without acoustic or electric instruments, this album. But it should be absolutely fascinating to see what we think of that. And also, if you know about Larry Fast yourself, then do leave some comments on the show notes for this week. We may not be back next week because it's going to be right in the middle of the Christmas break, in this part of the world anyway. And so it may be a week after that, but certainly to start off 2024 with our thoughts on this album, Electronic Realizations for Rock Orchestra. But for the moment, Mark, thank you very much indeed.
You're very welcome, Kevin.
This is Miguel Falcón at miguelbass.com. You are listening to the Yes Music Podcast.
Just before we go, here are the YMP producers and half the patrons. Yes Music Podcast producers are Joseph Cottrell, Ken Fuller and Jeffrey Cresselius. And half of the Yes Music Podcast patrons are Jim Morrison, John Pickles, Declan Logg, Gary Betts, Alan Begg, Michael Handahan, Barry Gorski, Steve Perry, Doug Curran, Martin Kelberg, Todd Dudley, Rachel Hadaway, Lind, Paul Hales, Craig Estenes, Mark James Lang, Steve Rode, David, Bob Martellotta, John Holden, Stephen Lamb, Dem, Fred Barringer, Scott Colombo, Chris Bandini, David Hayden, and John Thompson. Festive greetings, and thank you very much indeed to all those patrons and producers. If you'd like to help them in 2024, keep the lights on here at YMP Towers, please do head over to patreon.com, patreon.com/yesmusicpodcast, or click the link on yesmusicpodcast.com. So that's just about all the time we have this week and all the time we've got for 2023. Thank you so much for listening once again. We do hope to be back early in 2024, and in the meantime, please do keep listening and getting involved via x.com, Facebook or Instagram. So until next time, just remember, whatever your progressive rock question, the answer is yes. Welcome to the trailer for Anthem 52, my attempt to write a new choir anthem every week for a year. I'm Kevin Mulryan, and I hope you'll enjoy listening to my progress throughout 2024. Please do visit the website, anthem52.com, follow along on x.com at realanthem52, and send me a message to show at anthem52.com. In this introductory episode, I'll be telling you a bit about myself and why I've decided to take on this challenge. As I'm an old bloke, I have almost 50 years of musical experience to talk about, but I'll try not to be too long-winded or too boring. Your results may vary, of course. let's get underway. Why am I doing this somewhat bizarre project? My mother tells me I used to sit on the stairs of our family home in Edinburgh, Scotland, singing the songs I had learned at Sunday school. We left Edinburgh in 1977, so I'm guessing this was about 1975 or 76. I was born in 1970, so my musical interests began when I was fairly young. I started instrumental lessons at the age of 6. Apparently I was asked by my parents what instrument I wanted to play, and I said violin. I have no recollection of why I said violin, but I do remember my first violin teacher, Miss Kirakowska, telling me I had a good ear. I had no idea what that meant, but it sounded fun. After moving to Stratford-upon-Avon in England in 1977, I continued violin lessons with a local teacher, Mrs. Trigg, and passed grade 8 at the age of 14 in 1984. Looking back now, it's surprising to realise how far I'd come in only a few years with the violin. Sometimes I wonder whether I could have gone on to do a diploma, but life and other musical activity took me away from that route. I'm not sure I would have relished giving up the number of other enjoyable activities I surely would have had to in order to spend the time needed to prepare for a diploma. I always felt strong musically, but not technically, a theme I will undoubtedly come back to in this podcast. So the amount of work required would have been huge. I joined Holy Trinity Church Choir in Stratford in 1979. It's the church where William Shakespeare and his family are buried, so it's world famous. It's a bit of a complicated story, with time out for university and other reasons, but if you come to a service at Holy Trinity today, you'll find I'm still there singing tenor, and my daughter Charlotte is in the treble line. My son Edward and my wife Sarah have also been in the choir. In fact, Sarah was one of the very first female members. I'm sure more of this story will be included in forthcoming episodes, so stay tuned if you're vaguely interested in that. I went to Homerton College, Cambridge University in 1989 with Sarah, and we both joined the Cambridge University Musical Society Chorus. Sarah before me, in fact. There is a probably apocryphal tradition that the Cums Chorus, as it was called, is conducted by the Director of Music at King's College. So we benefited from the amazing experience of choral training from the late Stephen Clearbury, who was at King's from 1983 to 2019. He conducted the chorus from 83 to 2009. Subsequently, Sarah and I joined Trinity Hall Chapel Choir, where organ scholars Mark Ford and Rupert Demery created an inexhaustible supply of anecdotes, which will probably appear in the coming weeks as well. The choir path I've taken is perhaps the most important one for this project, but I have enjoyed a wide and varied musical experience which I think has influenced how I compose. It's important to say that I don't play the piano, and that's one of the main causes of my debilitating imposter syndrome. Two valiant teachers tried to help me with keyboard skills, but due to my ineptitude, not theirs, I remained stubbornly incompetent. My Stratford teacher, Mrs. Pring, helped me to pass grade 2 when I was 18, but then I failed grade 3 shortly later, and I knew it was time to give up. At university, the remarkable Annette Heilbronn again tried to encourage me, but with little success. However, I did manage to persuade her to let me go to her house and play the harpsichord, forte piano and clavichord she owned, which filled up the whole of her tiny living room. The harpsichord apparently came from Queen's College, Oxford. Needless to say, I couldn't play any of them, but it was lots of fun. As I had only ever experienced single-line melodic music reading, violin and voice, I found the two-stave piano notation very difficult. I remember learning the left hand of my pieces off by heart, so I could read the right hand on its own. Thus, my sight-reading abilities were non-existent. I also assumed that everyone who played the piano from an early age must instinctively know about mysterious things like chords and key signatures. I don't now think this is true, but it fed into my assumption that I couldn't do harmony. It was the only aspect of my degree in music and education I struggled with. This was compounded by the assumption, undoubtedly imagined, that all the musicians I met who could play the piano looked down on me. It didn't help that I moved in pretty rarefied musical circles, where I encountered a great deal of elitism. I very much wanted to be involved in composer groups at Cambridge, but I felt I wouldn't fit in simply because I found the technical aspects of composing difficult. I didn't understand harmony, and I couldn't play my compositions to myself on the piano. Computer music systems were very basic in 1989. One of my lecturers and his son did use one of the first digital audio workstations, which certainly wasn't called that at the time. But it wasn't made available to students, and anyway, the jazz music programmed by my tutor's son seemed so complex and unattainable that I was put off even inquiring about this mysterious system. Despite this, the highlight of the course for me were the regular composition days that most of my fellow students hated. At 9 a.m. we were given three alternative topics and had to return no later than 5 p.m. with a completed piece of music, handwritten on manuscript paper. I imagine what I produced was odd, but the process cemented my desire to write my own music. When the time came for a special study, I chose to write a symphonic movement, reduced in scope from an entire symphony. It was called Oppression, and was for a strange combination of full orchestra and a small group of soloists, a trombone, a flute, and something else, I think. The problem was that it took me a very long time to write it all out by hand, and anyway, I couldn't hear what I'd written because I couldn't even play parts of it on the piano. I seem to remember my composition tutor calling it mad. He also, memorably, said when he heard I was going to be doing a composition special study with him, that my writing was among the more interesting of the students in my year. Damning with faint praise? After a lot of hard work, I ended up receiving a 2 for the piece. The scale used was like a simplified version of a degree classification. One of my fellow students gained a 1st for her piece for string quartet and children's choir. I imagine it was rather more successful than mine. After all, she could play the piano. After that element of the course was over, I still maintained my desire one day to compose something decent. I ended up writing a set of responses for Trinity Hall Chapel Choir. In case you don't know, responses are sung as a set of call and response prayers between the priest and the choir at evensong. Mine were terrible. I didn't really write anything after that. However, I did go back to them 15 years later in 2008, and, to put it politely, revised them. In fact, I completely rewrote them, using the free software MuseScore. Even though it was in a fairly basic state at the time, I started to realise that modern compositional tools might be able to rekindle my aspirations. For the first time, I could write music in traditional notation and then hear it played back to me. I know systems like MuseScore were developed earlier than 2008. For example, my wife and I did have an unhappy experience with Sibelius, which is a story for another day. But this was my first experience, and I was surprised that I could make significant improvements to the responses just by listening and shifting notes around. The results were pleasing, and the director of music at my choir agreed to include them in choral evensong services, as did the director of music at Homerton College. This all helped me a little with my imposter syndrome. Perhaps I could actually create music people would be happy to hear. Or at least not so bad they felt compelled to tell me they didn't like it. After this experience, I tried to use MuseScore to write anthems, but unfortunately it went badly. I'm not sure why. For example, I did finish a carol, but when the choir sang it at Christmas Midnight Mass, I realised it didn't work. I suppose this put me off once again, and I didn't return to writing for several more years. After this somewhat depressing catalogue of false starts, it wasn't until 2023 that I tried again. This time, the most recent director of music at Holy Trinity Church, Douglas Keilitz, had found my responses in a cupboard in the choir vestry and decided to tell me that we should give them another airing. Completely coincidentally, I had been toying with the idea of adding something new to the responses. The latest version of MuseScore seemed to include some dramatic improvements, and this prompted me to think about a missing element of the responses, the Lord's Prayer. There are lots of different versions of responses written over the centuries, and the majority of them have the Lord's Prayer sung, or rather chanted, on a single note, with a concluding four-part cadence. The minority have the fully composed Lord's Prayer, with sopranos, altos, tenors and basses singing their own harmonic parts. My responses fell into the former category, and this had always irritated me. It was partly down to my imposter syndrome again. I felt I could write the short phrases needed for the choir in the rest of the responses, but the Lord's Prayer requires a longer format, which daunted me. However, I did download the newest version of MuseScore and gave it a go. To my amazement, I managed to write the complete Lord's Prayer very quickly. It just seemed to flow easily, and the resulting rendition at Choral Evensong in October 2023 went well. Encouraged by this success, I tentatively began to try my hand at a couple of anthems. The amazement continued, as the flow continued. I completed one in a few days, and the other is still incomplete, but only because I shifted my attention firstly to Christmas carols and then Advent carols. Within about 5 weeks, I had produced one complete anthem, one almost complete anthem, seven complete carols, and four complete Advent carols. That's 11 completed compositions. I suppose you could call this making up for lost time due to imposter syndrome. While most are short, and not all are very good, they at least all work and seem fairly pleasant to me. All of the above is by way of prologue. Buoyed up by this newfound and startling prolific ability, I started to think about how I could maintain it. If I managed to keep composing, surely I'd get better. My thoughts wandered to some interesting places. Recently I've heard about the Kickstarter campaign for Descants Are For Life, a new collection of 140 descants to 125 popular hymns arranged by Paul Walton. Strangely enough, Paul was a member of my choir in Stratford and also composed a descant for my wife and my wedding in 1994. Then there's the guy on YouTube who has written and recorded a new song every day for over 10 years. Jonathan Mann is his name. I certainly couldn't match that, but it was going to require something epic to keep me going, so I thought I might be able to produce an anthem a week in 2024. This could be my BHAG. Is it pronounced BHAG? I don't know. Which stands for Big, Hairy, Audacious Goal. It's a term originally coined by Jim Collins and Jerry Porras in their book Built to Last, Successful Habits of Visionary Companies, first published in 1994. Collins says, the power of the BHAG is that it gets you out of thinking too small. A great BHAG changes the time frame and simultaneously creates a sense of urgency. So that sounds about right. The concept of Anthem 52 was created. So starting in the first week of 2024, I will publish a weekly podcast episode containing an explanation of the week's anthem and a rather poor MIDI instrument audio version of it, along the lines of the theme tune you've already heard, and presumably winced in reaction to. I hope to get a lot better at creating the MIDI versions as we go through the year. I hope you will join me next week, or perhaps the week after next, when it's actually 2024, for a new episode and a new anthem. But until then, the question remains, will I make it to Anthem 52?